Are you a parent or coach of an athlete aged 13 to 18? Are they receiving structured athletic development coaching or just training unsupervised, copy and pasting something from Instagram or bodybuilding.com, or training with a coach who isn't even qualified or experienced with youth athletes? Do you want to help your athlete improve their movement, nutrition, and mindset? Do you want to find a coach who specializes in youth athletes, has the highest level of qualifications, has over a decade of coaching experience and a proven track record of developing athletes for regional, national, and professional levels in multiple sports? Well, listen up, because this is for you. I've recently created two ways that young athletes can now work with me. Firstly, in person within our Athlete Academy after school sessions in Edinburgh, and secondly, via the Athlete Academy Online, our online training platform for young athletes without physical access to structured athletic development support. To find out more, head to our website, www.athleticevolution.co.uk, to inquire and find out more about the Athlete Academy, helping young athletes to improve movement, nutrition, and mindset to dominate in sport and in life. This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets, just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable, and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's S-T-A-T-E-R-A.uk. Welcome to the Athletic Evolution Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Ben Pullen. Ben is a PhD student in the Youth Physical Development Centre at Cardiff Metropolitan University. His research focuses on the impact of strength and conditioning on the athletic motor skill competencies and the psychological attributes of youths. His PhD is a joint project with the Welsh Institute of Performance Science, Sport Wales, and Swansea University. Welcome to the podcast, Ben. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for giving us the time this morning. So for those who haven't come across you and your research and what you're doing, give us a bit of a background of your journey in sport and how that's evolved into what you're doing today.
So my journey in sport, I grew up on a farm. So I was quite physically active as a child, always out and about, camping in the fields, doing this, that, and the other. I had like sort of friends who were very active as well, and we were kind of that generation I don't know if it's still about, but we would ride to each other's houses and then go find the biggest hill we could ride down and all that sort of stuff. And then I had like mountain boards and would go down massive hills on that, and had like a trampoline. Super fortunate to grow up with a trampoline in the garden, so we'd spend hours on that. And I think those sort of experiences were like the first taster for me, and I clearly can see now that I valued that stuff as a child and really enjoyed it. And then sport, I guess I started getting into sports at secondary school, sort of rugby, cricket, athletics. I was the kid who loved all the sports but just probably wasn't that successful. Played lots of sports, was playing, in the summer, playing loads of cricket games, doing athletics at school. And then I think as I got older, and why I guess I started to lean towards S&C was I started to recognize that I actually just enjoyed being active and training and more than sport itself. Ended up getting a set of gymnastics rings and sticking them in the barn, and was like every day was seeing if I could do something new on them. And I think that's where things started to change for me and go, actually, this is what I value. This is what I enjoy, and then I guess end up doing S&C at uni, and sort of, yeah, the pathway just snowballed from there. I think as well, it was kind of hard for me to, I think we don't really understand what S&C is until we actually start learning it. We like see it on Facebook, like, oh, it's gym, right? That stuff's really fun. And then you get into it, oh, whoa, there's so many different avenues of this. And so I guess that's how it kind of went from being physically active, enjoying sport, but actually switching over to enjoying training more, and then ending up, yeah, in the right degree, I guess. And the career kind of got a couple of green lights, which I was lucky, and it snowballed from there.
And obviously that's now, you know, you've evolved from doing your undergraduate degree to now, you know, as you mentioned, at the back end of a PhD. So how did that kind of little opportunity open up?
So I'd say I've had, like, have you ever driven to work and you got all the green lights happen at the same time? And I feel like that's my career. And so far, it's not been the longest career yet. You know, I'm still very early and really fortunate. But so I did my undergrad. I was really lucky to sort of get a job as a graduate S&C coach at Marlborough College. And there was kind of a link with the head of S&C, James Davis. He was an ex-graduate from Cardiff Metropolitan, and he'd reached out to John Oliver, actually, and they put a few of us forward for interview sort of thing. And so I ended up there, and amazing opportunity, loved my time there. Got so much hands-on coaching, and then sort of came to the end of that, and I was just, well, actually, the kind of how I fell into the research was, at the end of my time at Marlborough, I kind of, we delivered S&C on the PE curriculum, and I hadn't done a master's at the time, so I remember reaching out to John Oliver and saying, oh, you know, I've just delivered S&C as part of the PE curriculum for the last year. I think there's something here. Like, could I do this as my master's thesis? Could I research this? I've lined up a control school. Marlborough are happy for me to come back next year and use the data. So I had those conversations were starting. I didn't know at the time that there was a very similar PhD in the woodworks being built through with a link with Sport Wales, the Welsh Institute of Performance Science, and Swansea University and Cardiff Metropolitan. So I was talking to John Oliver about this, and right towards the end of my time at Marlborough, John reached out and said, actually, like, you kind of have said what you wanted to research, and we've got a PhD that's on very similar lines. I'm like, oh no, like, I can't do a PhD. I haven't got a master's. Like, what am I going to do? Like, I'm useless at research. I can't. And then kind of, I thought I'd go for it. And it seemed just like the perfect fit. Like, I was so lucky that a PhD came up that was very, very relevant for me. Like, it was exactly what I'd done for a whole year at Marlborough, sort of coaching youth athletes, coaching in the PE curriculum. So I was just really fortunate, and that's kind of like, you know, right place, right time. Uni a year later, what would have happened and those things. Yeah, really fortunate with those sort of green lights.
So tell us a bit more about your time at Marlborough. Was that part of, like, you know, a lot of S&Cs in schools are obviously more performance focused, but you being part of the PE, was there a bit of both, or was it primarily kind of like participation and education focus?
It was both. Yeah, it was both. We were really fortunate. Well, firstly, we obviously did all the performance side of things, all the sports, sort of the, you know, talent identified youth athletes as well. We had a director of sport who was really on board. It was quite interesting. We were sort of the first year ever that S&C was in the school. So we kind of had to, a lot of it was pitching what we can do as an S&C department, you know, perceptions from teachers. You know, we're not here to just, you know, beef kids up as they thought, you know, it's holistic development. We want to reduce the risk of injury, those sort of things. And so we obviously did all the performance side, and we were really fortunate at Marlborough. We had like great testing equipment, all that sort of stuff. So we could really, it was really high performance. Like, we really had the diagnostic stuff that we could really get in and get some really good information. And then on the flip side, we had a head of PE who was just so on board with what we did. So we actually delivered sort of, I think it was 50% of their first 2 years of the PE curriculum was athletic development. So we, myself, James Davis, and the other S&C grad, Josh Wall, delivered S&C as part of the PE curriculum, which looked different to obviously what we would do with the high performance end stuff. It was more like learning the athletic motor skill competencies, some sprint mechanics, some track stuff, obviously making stuff fun, some stuff in their human movement studio. So we taught them how to move and some like basic bracing and all that stuff. I'm trying to remember what we did now. But and then also we got some really good buy-in in the summer from athletics. So actually as the SSC team, we got all the track athletes, so all the sprinters. So we were allowed to do, you know, I think it was like 2-3 times a week. We had 30 kids doing speed training with us, which was awesome. Just so I think like the reason, if you got a good graduate role like that, where a lot of the, you know, director of sport, head of PE are all on board, the coaching exposure was unbelievable. I mean, I can remember doing a team sport in the morning, maybe four PE lessons in the morning. Then straight after lunch, we'd have our athletes in, some rehabbers, some individual performance athletes. I could be coaching sort of 8-9 hours a day, which is just, and the thing, what was really cool, especially with the PE lessons, was you'd have the same PE lesson 4 times in a row. So the first lesson, my cueing might not have been very good. And I'd actually reflect on that and go, okay, why wasn't that resonating with me? Let's try it different. And the next lesson straight after, you've had a chance to rehearse and refine. And that was such a good learning process for myself. And then I think as well, just being around PE teachers, like I know S&C, we think we can change the world sometimes. But some of the PE teachers, I think, have been my most valuable learning experiences. And Marcus Sharrod at Marlborough College is just absolutely unbelievable. One of the best PE teachers I've ever seen. And just watching him do his thing in PE and him teaching myself and the other SSC coaches, he was unbelievable. And that was a great learning experience. So, yeah, we were really fortunate. We did have the performance element, but we also had the, you know, the participation element and trying to get it out to the masses, I guess.
Mm. So you've obviously mentioned a few names already in terms of John Oliver, James Davis, you know, some of the PE teachers. Are there any other experiences or people that have been influential in shaping your journey as a coach or your coaching practice?
I think I've got to say my supervisor. We'll go from the start. So yeah, James Davis at Marlborough College. Unbelievable coach, such a good coach, and he taught me so much. I can remember him having to sit down with me after like the first 6 weeks and like, Ben, get more vocal, get involved. And he was such a good mentor, and really, I guess, brought me out of my shell. I could be quite reserved sometimes, and he taught me to be the character on the gym floor. And then Josh Wall, the grad that I worked alongside, he was really good with the so I come fresh out of uni. I think Josh had a bit of experience before he started the grad role. So he was kind of like having little side conversations with me, like, oh, Ben, like maybe tweak this. Like that's not resonating with the children. And we had some fantastic conversations throughout that year. And still to this day, like we're always touching base and talking shop and trying to figure out, you know, what's the next answer or how's your program going? And then I think, obviously, I've got to mention my supervisory team. Having John and Rodri is just an absolute blessing. I'm so fortunate. I think John is just, it never fails to amaze me how smart that guy is. It's just, and sometimes I can remember, you're just so unexpected. I'd be reading a paper, completely nothing to do with my PhD, nothing to do with youth. Just because I was coaching some rugby at the time, doing some rugby, I said, oh, John, I read this really interesting paper. And he's just, his level of understanding on anything that's not even to do with something he's read at the time or even his area is just unbelievable. And you're just like, wow, like he's such a great thinker. And he really is the driving force of a lot of stuff at the research at Cardiff Met. And then Rodri Lloyd as well. He's been, I think as well, like I think, sometimes a lot of people say, you know, researchers don't know how to practically apply their research, and there's a bit of a divide, a bit alienated. You can't be both, you're either a researcher or a practitioner. And you go to Rodri, and he's just, his insight into the practitioner side, like his understanding of coaching is amazing. And I think people underappreciate that a little bit, because you see all his fantastic research, but you can go to Rodri and have an amazing coaching conversation. And I think that's why that's why he's got such amazing research as well. I think that insight, and to having John and Rodri just driving the research, guiding me along the way, has been amazing. Some awesome conversations. And then my third supervisor is actually Camilla Knight at Swansea Uni, and she's a sports psychologist, and her background sort of parent-child relationships in sports, sort of coaching child, and then the child development, psychological development. And having an in and out sort of sport youth psychologist on the supervisory team has been an absolute game changer for my own practice. I didn't really have much understanding or grasp on the psychology when I started my PhD, and she's really mentored me along the way. And just the way she thinks is outstanding. It's really, really positive, and just guiding my, like, I think as well, obviously it's the PhD is research, but what she's provided me is with, like, it's made me 10 times the better coach, having that understanding and those conversations, and just even just guiding. And I've really learned a lot from her and applied it to my own coaching, I guess. And then the other one, I think the other person you need to mention is Craig Harrison down in New Zealand. So I've been fortunate to cross paths with him twice. He actually came over to present at UKSCA in 2018, I think. I think it was 2018. It might have been early, I can't remember. But I wasn't aware of who he was at the time or what he was doing. And I actually got to have a quick sit down with him and John sort of before, the day before, had a little conversation, told him what I was doing my research. And I noticed he asked a lot of good questions. Craig is really good at asking the right questions. And then I got to see him present at the conference. And I was just on the tail end of my first intervention, which was, it was crazy to say the least. It was, nothing I'd ever experienced before. And I can remember him playing a few videos of how he was using that constraints-led approach and to get engagement on motor learning, but in like the athletic motor skill competition. It's like, this is really good. I wish I'd done more of this in my intervention. And I think the best thing about anyone's career is you can pick what you like from other practitioners. And some of the stuff from Craig, I was like, this is what I believe in. And because, my career was shaping me into the physical activity realm, into physical education. And then I was really fortunate. I went to New Zealand last November and touched base with him there. I went to Sprints conference down in New Zealand, and then was fortunate to go on a writing retreat with some of the AUT PhD students. And some of the conversations over a coffee, probably some of the most valuable parts of my career has just been sat there over a coffee, just, and like I think I've already said, but Craig just asks the right questions. You're talking about something and he just comes up with this question that spins off a new line of thought. And he's really good with that stuff. And I think as well, he posts some great content as well. You can always learn or get some great ideas from him and put that into your own coaching practice. So I'd say, those were the people that have really been influential on my career and kind of mentored me or had the right conversations. I'd say that's probably the people that are definitely worth mentioning and have really shaped my career so far.
Yeah, Craig's a great mind, isn't he? He's I was actually fortunate to get him on the podcast a few months back, and it was funny having him on the other side of the mic because obviously he runs his own podcast and some fantastic guests on his, but it was great to get his thoughts on, to kind of flip it around and get him as the guest. And he's he's got some fantastic thought processes, and I remember that conference, I was there as well, and that was a fantastic presentation. As you say, the clips of going, okay, here's what it's actually like to be in a session, here's what the sort of movement problems I'm setting the kids. And it's not just sets and reps. It's, we're exploring movement and there's almost no rules in some way of like, can you solve this problem? And how many different ways can you solve this problem? And he's a really great mind, I think.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, great stuff. And it was really nice when I got to go down to New Zealand. We did a pre-con day. So, and it was all the stuff from AD, from athlete development, sort of. They did some pracs. Some of the coaches there ran some pracs. And I was like, ah, yeah, this is, I like this. I really enjoy this stuff. And I think this is very similar to the lines I'm taking with my own research. And yeah, I kind of really found, I left New Zealand with this newfound enthusiasm for coaching. You know, sometimes you just need that, I think, a big refresh. And it just, yeah, come home and was just like, okay, yeah, this is what I want to do. This is how I need to mold my own coaching now. And so yeah, Craig's awesome.
So how is how have those influences shaped your coaching philosophy over the years? So how's that evolved from that fresh-faced undergraduate who's finished his degree to where you are now? What's changed in your coaching philosophy? What are you placing more value on that you didn't used to, or vice versa?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think while I was at Marlborough, I really liked, I guess, sort of holistic athleticism. So I didn't think like the qualities between a lot of sports were that different. Like I was really big on plyometrics, love plyometrics. I believe, you know, all athletes should have the ability to, you know, deal with force in multiple contexts, being confident and competent, you know. And I think like being able to navigate and maintain orientation through different forces. I think, you know, I used to sort of very similar between like rugby sevens and netball, the plyometric stuff I was doing, that explosive stuff. That was kind of my philosophy. I just really liked developing explosive athletes, but ones that were resilient to perturbations and could, you know, really reproduce movements in lots of contexts. I think that was the early days after leaving Union. And I think it's like, I think my philosophy has evolved actually as a, in response to my career. So I think like my career shaped my philosophy and not the other way around. I think I've been put into environments where I've gone, wow, like been an eye opener and I've really had to change. So I think my philosophy now, and try not to make this super long winded, but I think I need to give a bit of context to it. So through my research, I've delivered interventions in some of the poorest parts of Wales, you know, and I think until you get thrown into a school where, and I never experienced anything like it. I'd never seen a school environment like it. And so I was having to deliver interventions in these really, really lower socioeconomic status areas. And when you get into those environments and you've got, I can remember having 30 boys in one of my PE lessons. I just asked, oh, like who plays for the school rugby team? And like one hand went up and I was just like, whoa, this is different. This is like, you know, we're so used to it. Like, how all the boys are playing in the rugby team, especially in Wales. and I was just like, okay, this is different. There's no, none of them are physically active. They're not, they don't value sports. You know, PE is the only activity they have during the week. And that environment is completely different. If you go in with the expectation of, oh, this is S&C, this is fun, kids will value it, like you get eaten alive. And that those experiences started to shape what I believe was my value as a coach. So I guess where I am, I think my philosophy aligns with my aims. I don't think this philosophy is for everyone. I don't think it should be generalized to other people. I think it's just what my aim is now as a practitioner. And I believe, like we always say in S&C, like S&C is to make the boat go faster. You know, we're here to supplement sport. We want to reduce the risk of injury and make, you know, improve athleticism, improve performance. And my philosophy is like, well, what if we take the boat out of the equation? What is our role as an S&C coach? Like if there's no boat to make, to get to go faster, you know, like what is my role? Like what am I doing with these children? And once you take the performance element out of it, it's then understanding what we can actually do as an S&C coach. So I take the performance element out and then look at the holistic development of the child and look at the long-term development of the child. So I'm trying to, my aim and my philosophy is to try develop children to be prepared for life. And people might say, oh, you're an S&C coach, that's completely out of your remit. And I think it is a little bit, but it's not as well. So I think like if we look at sport, a few things that I've identified in sport. So very, very few athletes make it into professional sport, okay? And then very few athletes actually continue playing sport as an adult. So instantly, if our whole journey of LTAD is to get people into academies, to get contracts and stuff, we're failing the masses. We're completely failing the masses. So I'm trying to think about those children, preparing children who aren't going to get the contracts and who aren't going to carry on playing sport in later life. So what are the skills that I can give them very early on to be successful and continue to navigate their environments and to continue to want to participate in a healthy, active lifestyle once sport isn't a thing? You know, once school sport stops, how many children are actually carrying on with sport? And I think as well, sorry, this is super long philosophy, I think, so we've obviously already identified that a lot of children aren't going to make it into academies and stuff. So we want to provide skills. And I also think my philosophy aligns to how can S&C be in an activity that benefits children in a way that sport doesn't? Now, one thing I strongly believe in is if we look at sport and most sports traditionally, sort of rugby, football, netball, any of these sports are massively underpinned by locomotor abilities. So the child that's going to be successful is a child that is fast. And, you know, a lot of it's anthropometrics, genetics, you know, people are naturally faster. So you have so many kids who absolutely love sport, but never have the opportunity to be really successful because they just weren't gifted with locomotor abilities. You know, their anthropometrics, their structure, their physiology just doesn't allow for it. So as time progresses, as they get older and go through sport and, you know, their cognitive abilities to perceive their own competence get better because the limitations diminish, they're going to start to lose that self-esteem. They're going to start to, you know, peer comparison comes in. I'm not scoring tries. My friend scores tries. I'm not getting X amount of runs. I'm not getting as many shots in netball, etc. So already sport is failing a lot of children who just don't have that ability to be successful in sport. Now, S&C is an activity, actually, you can flip that. And the reason I say this is because S&C is a fantastic example, if done right, of how an activity can challenge competency and also offer an opportunity to be successful in every session. So a child can, like, every challenge that you set, if you challenge competence optimally, so provide differentiation between children and recognize what they're on the, what they're very close to achieving, give them that, and over a few weeks as they achieve these activities, it might be swinging from one base to another, or can they swing off a set of rings and land a certain way, or we introduce the hex bar deadlift, can they, and you just gently increase the weight. Every session there's an opportunity for a child to be successful and start to recognize, actually, I'm good at this. This is what I value. This is something I'm good at. And it becomes a separate activity. So when we do that, S&C, actually, we detach it from sport and it just becomes a space for a child to come in and feel better about themselves, enjoy their time there and feel competent in what they're doing. And I think so there's the masses of children that are getting failed by sport. And it's not an issue. I'm not saying, like, let's get rid of sport. That's not it at all. Let's provide opportunities as coaches for the kids who aren't going to be successful in sport to really, really start to love physical activity. And the positive consequence of that is they're going to get stronger and reduce the risk of injury. If you set up the games in the right way, you get physical qualities in a certain way. So to really cap off a really long-winded answer, my philosophy is to sort of put the child at the center and not worry about sport until sort of, you know, post peak height velocity. Just give them the skills and sort of periodize my training that I can just really, really develop intrinsic motivation to be there, and that a child over years can develop an absolute love for training and make it age appropriate. So it might be just games and physical challenges to start with, the structuring, and just to play the long game. We're only as good as the athletes that stay in our program. Like, so many good athletes leave the program because they just don't enjoy the sport or they don't enjoy the training. So getting them, if you can get a child from his earliest six and they're still with you at 18, then that's, I think that's the most successful pathway for a child. And I guess that's my philosophy now, is putting the child first, really, really tapping into their psychological needs and trying to be really aware of the developmental sort of stage they're at within their training and within their own growth.
That was fantastic. I think you've just nailed it there for me. Like, I couldn't agree more with what you've just said. Everything from, you know, the fact that so few athletes will make it into performance sport and so few athletes will stay, and that, you know, what we're doing is failing the masses because by focusing on that one golden egg, when actually we could be giving so many more kids the skills to solve problems, to increase confidence, competence, physical abilities, and lifelong physical development, which is really what we're talking about. I think Joe Eisenman put it really well when I spoke to him. He said, you know, one of the issues is we talk about long-term athlete development, and loads of people think, oh, well, I'm not an athlete. Well, actually, if you've got a body, you're an athlete. So it should be long-term physical development. And when we frame it like that, well, hang on, what's happening to the long-term physical development of that kid who left that under 12 football team because he didn't feel confident, didn't feel like he was, you know, he was part of the team, he wasn't good enough or whatever. And I think what you've said there is just, it's you've banged it on. I mean, same conversation I had with Brett Kleeker around, you know, actually we can develop confidence and teach kids, you know, you can strive and become something different to what you are today. You can improve your strength, your speed, your power. You can improve your confidence. You can improve your self-esteem. I think you're absolutely right. And a lot of S&Cs are missing this whole other toolbox of benefits by purely focusing on these physical outcomes.
Yeah, 100%. And I think just as well, I think sometimes and I don't think this is anyone's fault, but I don't think we nurture talent very well. And when we look at using S&C to just supplement sport, I think we fail talent a little bit nurturing it. And I just give a really quick example, sort of the early developer in boys, you know, gets that increase in testosterone way quicker, way faster. And within sport, we instantly put them into positions where they might be on the wing in rugby, and we tap into their, you know, early development. They're faster, they're more powerful. And because we've tapped into performance and maybe not given them the skills in the gym or the skills on the pitch, when that child then hasn't got the understanding of the game later in life and hasn't developed the to be prepared to fail in a way. Like, so when people start to catch them up and they're not as good, have we set them up to have another identity than just I'm the fast guy who scores loads of tries? Do they have another identity? It's like, oh, well, I'm also the guy who's quite good at doing this in the gym, so I'm going to carry on and stick with it. And on the flip side, you know, the late developer who loves sport but doesn't get the opportunity to thrive, and actually, even though they didn't get to thrive, if we can tailor our training that they love the training environment, they might stay in sport a bit longer until actually they do catch up physically. And I think that's what we're missing a little bit. And I think, not to say that everyone's missing it, there's some absolutely amazing coaches doing amazing things. I just think that's where I see it. And I think as well, just because we spoke about this earlier, the way sport lends itself is like the high quality coaching comes at the end. And there's just people who don't quite understand this stuff coaching the kids, and that's no fault of their own. Often it's just parents. And why should a parent know all this stuff? Like, they've got these really important jobs, they're busy, they've got like three kids. Why are we saying that they've got to know all the psychological and physical development of children as well? So I think, like, yeah, that's another avenue for S&C to try sort of tap into that and recognize those things.
I think it's interesting because the real buzzword in sports performance and S&C is athlete-centered, isn't it? Whereas actually, as you said, well, in order to be truly athlete-centered, you actually need to take the sport out of it. And ultimately, at some point, everyone will stop playing. There's not many 90-year-old rugby players. You know, so everyone, no matter how glorious a career you have, if you become a British Lion, if you win the World Cup, at some point you will wake up and you will not be a professional rugby player anymore. Just like that kid who gets deselected or the kid who gets injured. So everyone is encountering this, but are we actually setting them up for it? Not really.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Completely agree with you. We need to prepare children for the realities and giving them an alternate identity, that when they get 18 and they don't get the pro contract, that they just fall off the face of the earth. Actually, we've given them skills that they go, do you know what? I might just go play this sport, or I might end up in CrossFit or whatever it is, you know, just give them as long as we've given them enough skills that they can be adaptable and carry on in the physically active realm, then that's how what I'm trying to do anyway, and that's how I align my aims and my philosophy, I guess.
So let's dive into your research, because that is a real nice segue in terms of some of the things you've been looking at. So give us a bit of an overview of, okay, what's the kind of topics that you've been delving into? And then I guess you could talk us through some of the studies and the outcomes.
So I guess the study was born out of Sport Wales. And so Sport Wales have identified that many of their athletes coming into their pathway are still really lacking competency. They really lack the fundamental movement skills, the athletic motor skill competencies, you know, and that's understandable because these things don't develop naturally. They are a product of the environment, whether it's coaching, whether it's learning them themselves. But I think we have a bit of a misconception that talented or athletic populations in youth are competent in athletic motor skill competencies when the research has actually shown that they're not really at all. So Sport Wales identified that, and I guess they thought the approach that makes sense and is logical is, instead of trying to fix the problem once they get into the pathway, is how can we fix this problem earlier on through physical education? You know, and I think physical education is probably what, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the only thing I can think of that is completely involved in the masses. Every child, hopefully, gets the opportunity to participate in physical activity. So it seems the logical step to, you know, counteract a lot of issues. And not even, and Sport Wales weren't just doing it for the performance side of things. They also identified that, you know, there could be some real benefits of this. You know, can we make kids stronger, more resilient to risk of injury? And what are the psychological impacts of that? So if we do an S&C intervention, does their intrinsic motivation improve? Their physical self-efficacy, sort of their confidence towards a given task, and maybe self-esteem, their feelings of worthiness. Can we improve those through a physical S&C intervention as such? So Sport Wales recognised both sides. Like, can we fix the problem of them coming into the pathway, but also can we fix the problem? You know, we're seeing physical inactivity levels through the roof at the moment. And, you know, can it positively benefit health, well-being, strain on the NHS that we're seeing later on? So that's where it came from. So I guess a few things within my own PhD. So I've sort of got like three reviews at the start, just ones on development of movement skills, and then one on psychological development from sort of birth to adulthood. From early childhood, sorry, to adulthood, and then a review on movement screens. And hopefully I'll have those out maybe like early next year, sort of mid next year, with, you know, the peer review process and getting those tied up. I've done three major studies. So one was the pilot study that was published on Saturday. So that was kind of really nice to get that one out there. That's a feasibility study. I don't think we should look at the results and go, whoa, this is the P is going to change improved competency. I think it's more actually like that study for me was going in and going, what does PE look like? What's S&C going to look like in PE? And I think I overestimated this massively. And I think this is another thing as well we're seeing sort of, so S&C is, you know, it's getting into schools. We're seeing it. All these schools are getting S&C coaches in. It's mainly in the private sector, which is completely understandable. It's money at the end of the day. And these S&C coaches work in performance. And then some of these S&C coaches are being involved in PE. And a lot of them are doing a really good job of, you know, reverse engineering things and actually what are the needs of the kids, like not just performance. And a lot of them are doing, I've had some great conversations with some S&C coaches that are already doing that. But I feel that, you know, it's a misrepresentation when we compare what's going on in private schools and trying to scale that into public schools. Okay, so like a lot of private schools will still, in their PE curriculum that the S&C are delivering, will look at acceleration mechanics, will look at change of direction of speed and look at, you know, lots of the athletic motor skill competencies. But I always wonder why, like, and I know that is a really controversial thing to say, like, why obviously you want to get faster and underpin sound mechanics, but like, it's all still, to me, feels like it's still supplementing sport a little bit too much. But it's not, I think the thing why it's working in private schools is because it just does, like the kids are good. You've got the facilities to facilitate that stuff and the coaches are really good. So I think actually, like, I'm not saying they shouldn't be doing that because the coaches are so good at what they do, like their language, their positive feedback, all that stuff, that the kids love it. But then when you take that, and this is why I say, why are we doing that? When you take the acceleration mechanics and try to do it in a public school where sports participation is really low, behavior issues, truancy, and you start to look at it and go, this isn't what they need. Like, what do they need? And they need to start to value exercise at the absolute basics. So that first study that I did was all about feasibility and figuring out, how can I get value out of these kids? And I think I've already mentioned that it was, you know, in some pockets where I worked in that pilot study, sort of child poverty levels were around 60%, which is blew me away when I found that out, when I looked at the health observatory and was just like, wow, this is, okay, what do these children need? What can I give them? Because this is the only physical activity they're doing. And I think that's when I started to realize, like, I think a lot of things are changing in S&C at the moment. We're going games-based and it's quality. It's so good to see. We're seeing movement challenges popping up everywhere, games-based approaches, and some people are really leading the field with that. But I think where I think we still need to get the nail on the head is informed games and informed programming. And you can have a completely unstructured session that is still structured. So like my sessions on paper, I have a structure to, and I call it organized chaos. So I have structure and I know what physical qualities I'm trying to achieve, but the games, the challenges, and that the children don't realize, you know. And sometimes I tell them why we're doing stuff and, you know, coach it out of them. But I think you need to look at a game. So I always do it backwards. So I go, right, what's the physical quality I'm really trying, I want to hit in this session? And it might be single leg plyometric ability or single leg stability, or it might be the ability to brace or some supplementary strengthening of the shoulder joint before we, like, eventually want to get into pull-ups or pressing and stuff like that. So I always think backwards. I go, what's my physical quality? What's my athletic motor competency? What is the structure I'm trying to strengthen? And then how can I put that into a game? And I think if we do it the other way around and we go, oh, this is a really fun game, and then we lose touch of the qualities a little bit. So these were just things that I started to realize in that first study. It was a very difficult study. Attendance rates were really low. And it's no fault of anyone's, like, it's just a demographic, and the PE teachers there were doing an awesome job anyway of coaching these children doing their PE. And so that pilot study taught me a lot about the feasibility of implementing this stuff. And I think that was one of my most valuable learning experiences in my career, because it tested me as a coach day in, day out. Like, I can remember having to just think of stuff that was just innovative all the time, just constantly changing how I approach things. And that's what I think, that was the first big step in that shift from where my philosophy was at Marlborough and where I was at, where I am now. And that was the big shift. So that was the first study. The second study is a cross-sectional analysis. So I've just got a big old data set of school children. I've looked at their athletic motor skill competencies, assessed that, sort of looked at injury risk factors, physical performance, and looked at the sports they participate in, and looked at motivation, level of motivation, sort of physical self-efficacy, and global self-esteem. So some of those psychological factors, which I also investigated in the first study. And I think we can be a bit naive as S&C coaches. Well, I'm not labeling everyone as naive. I was naive. That's what I'm saying. I was naive to start with. So I thought, yeah, if I go in and do this intervention, I'm going to improve the way they perceive themselves. I'm going to improve motivation. And And I think when you start to realize that those things take time to develop and take time to emerge, I think I've got a better grasp on what those things mean to me now. So those are the things that I've looked at, trying to see if improving competency also translates to psychological attributes in children. And in that first study, we didn't really see much change except for the male intervention group improve their motivation, their intrinsic level of motivation significantly. And it was such a small sample size, you know, I think they just generally enjoyed PE and they found something that resonated with them. And I think they just stemmed from that. I don't think it should be generalized and go, SSC is going to improve motivation in boys. That's not what those findings kind of allude to. And then I did a main intervention study, and this was building on key learnings from that pilot study. It was longer in duration. I was in a school that was in a bit of a stronger demographic. It was still in an area of higher levels of poverty, but it was a bit of an easier environment to deliver. And like in my pilot study, I didn't really have any facilities. Like quite often I'd be coaching in a car park or the school cafeteria. But the main study, I had the same sports hall. I had continuity there. And I looked at sort of their athletic motor skill competencies, their physical performance. And it was really successful. Both girls and boys improved their athletic motor skill competencies. I think for anyone who's not familiar with athletic motor skill competencies, they're kind of an extension of fundamental movement skills. And check out Rodri Lloyd's paper, the part two from 2015. Rodri, I can't remember the title of it completely. But they're just an extension of fundamental movement skills. And, you know, it can be to push and pull horizontally in the upper body, both vertically and horizontally, or be able to, you know, load the lower limbs bilaterally and unilaterally, trying to brace the core, anti-rotation exercises, jumping, rebounding with sound mechanics and sort of acceleration and stuff like that. The main study was, so we investigated those things. We investigated their competency and looked at some psychological attributes. And the effect size was really strong. I can't remember off the top of my head. I probably should, but I think it was over one. So I think like 0.9 we consider to be like a really good effect size. So an 11 weeks, once a week, 40 minutes of S&C, games, challenges, exploration, and some coaching was enough to significantly and strongly and with a big effect size change these children's athletic motor skill competency. I also looked at standing long jump as a physical performance measure. Now, I think it's important that I sort of allude to sort of my intervention wasn't typical sets and reps. It just considered exposure. So I just thought, okay, how am I going to get 30 tuck jumps in this session and integrate that into a load of different games and those sort of things. So I didn't ever have like sets and rep structures. It was all just exposure. How can I get pogo jumps in? How can I get some stability elements? How can I get overhead squats into like team relays and stuff like that? So physical performance measure, boys significantly improve standing long jump. And we know that's correlated to sports performance. So already we're seeing a relationship to sports performance, but also, we're just improving physical performance in a PE cohort even. Psychological attributes, not much changed. Firstly, I should say the girls actually didn't significantly improve their standing long jump performance, but actually when we compared that to the control group, so with sexual maturation, after maturation, we see that decrease in neuromuscular control and decrease in physical performance in girls with the onset, increased estrogen, obviously increased fat mass. So it's harder to, you know, jump as far, essentially. So the control group's standing long jump performance significantly decreased. Now, the intervention group didn't. So even though I didn't improve performance, I limited the decrease that we see in line with sexual maturation in girls. So that was one thing, like it wasn't an improvement, but actually we're limiting the effects that we see after peak height velocity. Psychological attributes, we saw not much change in any of the groups except for a significant decrease in physical self-efficacy in boys. Now, I think people are like, whoa, hang on, you made them less confident physically, like towards that task. And I think it's important that we go, actually, these athletic motor competencies are very alien to children. Loads of them have never heard of a squat, never been introduced to these things. So actually, even though I improved their competency, by introducing them to these things, and they, I guess, were given the opportunity to recognize that they might not be as good at this. So actually, what we may see is a decrease in self-perceptions early on, and a decrease in physical self-efficacy early on. And then it might take longer for them to recognize and translate into, actually, I am good at these things, before they actually have improved. I think we see that a little bit as well. As coaches, we implement something new and go, oh, the kids, their confidence has improved so much. I think actually we misplace that, where actually it's their enjoyment for the movement has improved so much. They're smiling, they're loving it. But actually what they perceive their own ability to be may be something that we're not recognizing in them. I'm trying to think of study as well. So my last study then was actually a reflection on my main intervention. So I've written a paper in first person, confessing to all the issues that I faced, with child behavior, kids playing up, losing sort of, when a PE teacher goes on maternity leave and you get a replacement and they were disappearing, and all these things that kind of escape sort of representation in research. We publish a paper, oh, performance improved, or this improved, and it's like, well, what actually happened in the intervention? And I think in a PE environment, that's so important, because wow, like, kids, they don't have a filter, that if they don't enjoy it, they won't do it. That's, you know, it's, when you go into PE, there's no carrot, there's no, like, in academy it's like, right, you've got your sport, if you want to make it, let's do some S&C or whatever it is. You go into PE and they're like, well, this is, I don't care about this, like, this isn't for me. And I wrote a confessional tale where I just confess about, I try to be really transparent about the issues I faced, how I struggled with those, how I dealt with those, and then kind of the learnings I got from those. And then I guess, like, the other thing that I just want to talk about from my research was kind of how I implemented the interventions, because I think that was one of the really important things that aligns with my philosophy and what I'm doing in my own coaching, was how can I get so competition, right, for children is massive. They absolutely love competition. And there's a big divide between some coaches and some, not in S&C, I mean, generally, there's a big divide between, should we be competitive with kids? Like, should we allow kids to be competitive, or, you know, should we shift away from that? And I think, like, it's not black and white. I think it's really gray. Like, if you can shift the focus of the competition, you can get some really good value. And I'll give a little example. So quite often I would do a team relay, right? And I'd say, okay, you're in four teams. And the way I set those teams up, so it's really important to recognize how kids use peer comparison. So I'll just talk you through how I'd set this thing up and how the little bits along the way sort of considered the motivation, the psychology within children. So straight away, kids need to see that they've got a chance at winning, right? If you let kids self-select their teams, all the sporty kids will go together and all the others are like, well, I'm completely disengaging with this, so we don't stand a chance, why should I bother? So first thing I do is, like, kids come in, pick your pairs. So we've got a bit of autonomy, right? So they get to pick who they want to work with, you know, with their friends, and we'll play a game that was a competitive game that stimulated physical qualities that I desired to get out of the session. And then as soon as we've done that, I go, right, join up with another pair and we'll play a game in fours. So they're now thinking, wow, I've got autonomy. Well, they didn't know it, but I'm getting choice in these sessions. That you know, that's part of our psychological need, basic need for motivation, is autonomy. And so I give that to them. We'll play that game. I go, right, okay, in your groups of four, number yourselves 1 to 4. So it's a completely way of randomly setting up four teams. So now these teams are pretty evenly split by just being random. And then to create sort of an emotional attachment to the game, I'd be like, right, kids, you've got a minute to come up with a team name. So then they're already getting a attachment to the game. So they value the game because they've come up with a name. There's, you know, a bit of an attachment there. So they come up with names. Okay, in your four teams, we're going to do a team relay. So one of you will go, and you've got, and I'd have a band there, and you've got to do 10 overhead squats. And then the next thing is you've got to do 5 single leg squats on a bench. And then the next stage is, it might be some med ball slams. And then the next stage is another competency, like 5 lunges each leg. So if you set that off and you say go, right, children will just go full ham. Like they will not control any of their movements there. It will not look anything like you want it to look like. So competition and control don't go hand in hand. But as soon as you manipulate how children win, you can get control. So at that stage, I'd have the kids set up and I'd be like, right, I'm going to award 10 points to the team that displays the most effort and the best competency throughout the relay. And instantly they go, right, okay, how do I get 10 points for that? And then they start to recognize, actually, I need to work hard and really focus on my movement instead of being the first team back. And when I started to do that, that was a revelation for me. I was like, this is finally, I've made something that's competitive and they're demonstrating awesome control. So there we've got an opportunity for kids to be successful as a team. So they'll do the relay. And while one of them's going, I'd set a challenge between the whole team. I don't like sitting around. I don't want children to be sitting and waiting for their go. Okay, right. While each person goes, as a team, you've all got to stand on one leg and throw the med ball, a weighted med ball around the team constantly. And if it goes too slow, I'll take a point off. So they're launching this med ball around between them, standing on one leg. We're developing isometric qualities, stability. They're engaged. There's no sitting around while this game's going on. And then at the end of the relay, I'll have a board. I'll have all their team names and say, okay, this is the points you've got, and we'll play a few rounds. So the exposure, they've done 30 overhead squats, they've done this, and this, but it wasn't like, I want you to do 3 sets of 10. It was in a fun, engaging environment that had quite a lot of, perturbations in it, lots of changes and to improve functionality, really. So we do that. And then I'd say, right, in your teams, as an individual, you can now all score a point for your team. Everyone grab a cone and a tennis ball and put the cone and tennis ball on your head. And if you can perform squats, or it might have been lunges, or it might have been shoulder taps with the cone and tennis ball on their back. If you can do that for a whole minute without the cone and tennis ball falling off, run up to me and I'll give you a point for your team. So we've got a minute of perfect control. And that's how I implemented the constraints-led approach. So the cone and tennis ball on the head, great posture, okay? You know, a lot of kids, when they lunge, they drop their chest. We don't see that posture. So I'm getting a minute of exposure, a whole minute of either squatting with great thoracic extension or lunging with good control, because they know if they move too fast, the ball's going to fall off, right? So they know they have to move with control. And it's competitive. They can earn points for their team, but it's not. But it's control and competitiveness sort of working hand in hand and not against each other. So those are kind of the ways I implemented the constraints-led approach into my intervention, and kind of really started to recognize how to get value out of these sessions. And I guess that's just one small example of what my intervention looked like and how S&C isn't just, you know, your 3 sets of 8, your acceleration mechanics and stuff like that in within physical education.
I guess ultimately it's just having the creativity to use your imagination a little bit and say, okay, how can I hide this, isn't it? How can I create an activity that gets what I want but gives what they want?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
That's kind of the name of the game. So look, reflecting back on all your research so far, what would be the main kind of message that you would kind of summarize in terms of what you've discovered?
Well, I think one thing to recognize is that process versus product. So when we're looking at movement competency, a lot of the literature is all about a product. So how far did they jump? How much force did they produce? And those things, I think, take longer to emerge. But when we look at competency, which is looking at the process of how they move, so like using a movement screen and using retrospective grading against performance criteria, when we look at that, actually exposure is king, and not maybe, because obviously product to maximize strength adaptations, et cetera, we want sets and reps. But actually when we're looking at movement competency, if we've got the engagement and enjoyment there, exposure will do the work for you. And I think that's in the results, like both interventions significantly improve motor skill competency in the athletic motor skill competency, sorry. And in my pilot study, as little as 5 sessions was effective in making a significant change. And then, and more exposure, the better. The main intervention had more exposure and we had a larger effect size. So I think we can move away from thinking about sets and reps and exposures, you know, typical hypertrophy schemes, strength schemes, power schemes. And for most of learning within S&C to improve competency, we can just look at exposure and how can we get those exposures in the fun, engaging way.
No, that's fantastic. That's something I would certainly say that I've kind of moved away from thinking with younger athletes is I'm not thinking of sets and reps as getting a stimulus. I'm thinking about giving you practice. And this is one of the conversations I had with one of the coaches that works under me. Was he, you know, kind of gave me a program to overview, and I said, "What's the problem with your periodization here?" So, what do you mean? I said, "You're giving them less and less practice. You've gone from 3 10s to 3 8s to 4 6s." That I was like, "All you've done is give them less of what we're trying to give them. Like, I don't care about. We're not here. We're not looking at strength. They're not looking at hypertrophy. We're looking at technical development. So let's give them more exposure," which is exactly what you're saying. It's like, actually, maybe the sets and rep scheme isn't that important. You know, at 10, 12 years old, maybe it's just let's get more exposure to doing these movements and understanding how we interact with space and time.
Yeah. And that's when we can then introduce variability. Like your physical quality might be to be able to work the lower limb unilaterally. And actually you can think about thousands of ways to do that. And as long as you're trying to stay consistent with the quality that you want to move, you can improve, you can actually change the way you approach it. Okay. So we don't have to be periodizing, sort of hoping for adaptations through consistency of the stress we put on the body. Actually for motor learning, we can, as long as we're trying to be, we need some consistency. Don't just go crazy every session. We need like some themes, keeping the themes within motor learning to allow these things to emerge. And I think that's Craig Harrison's stuff is really, really good on variability. I think he's a man to talk to. I think I even listened to the podcast and he nailed it with the variability stuff. And variability gets engagement because constantly it's a new task, it's a new challenge, I want to engage in this. Kids disengage really quickly. Like one game that was amazing 1 week, you do it again, like, oh, I've played this.
Which is funny because that's the complete opposite of any 3-year-old who's got a favorite film, isn't it? They want to watch it every day. That's really good. Some awesome information there and some really good takeaways, I think, for people who are practically working with kids. And as you say, you know, the effect that can have on movement competency, which isn't a given, despite how talented that athlete might look or perceive themselves to be. So what's your thoughts in terms of if people were wanting to learn a bit more about this area or kind of expand their understanding? Are there any resources, obviously, besides your own studies and your own kind of research gate profile, where would you sign point people to, you know, be it books, podcasts, anything that might be, you know, consumable for coaches?
I think there's 3 books that I think are sort of really fundamental. and this isn't biased because they're my supervisors. This is just, they're just, the content's fantastic. So Camilla Knight, one of my supervisors, her book, I've got it in front of me, so I get the title right, Sports Psychology for Young Athletes. That is so applicable for everyone who works with children, who's a coach. I think all S&C coaches should read it. There's some chapters in there, absolutely fantastic. And you can use those approaches to improve motivation, intrinsic motivation, sort of orientation for success, sort of task orientation, ego orientation, all that stuff. And understanding that in children will give you another tool in the toolbox, essentially, just understanding how children tick and using that to your advantage, I guess. And just having that understanding is really important. So that book is fantastic, a great, great read. John and Rodri's book, obviously, it's the holy grail of S&C and youth. We know their research is fantastic. So it's on the second edition now. So the first edition is awesome. Second edition is really, really good as well. Really practically applicable as well. And then the third book for me that I really enjoy is the Constraints-Led Approach, Principles for Sports Coaching and Practice Design. That's a really good one as well, just to understand how to use constraints in like a motor learning realm. That's a great book. I say those are the three books that I think, because they're quite easy to digest. They're not too content heavy. They're quite, you know, they're not really thick textbooks. They're, you know, short and sharp. The information's there. They haven't made it super, like, there's still a lot of information, but they haven't overdone it. Like, it's really user friendly for practitioners, and I think they're written so well. It's the Renshaw sort of cohort. So Ian Renshaw, Keith Davids, Daniel Newcomb, and Will Roberts. So they've got quite a lot of research in constraints-led approach. They've applied it to like pedagogy and within physical education and within sports context. So that's a great book. I definitely say have a read of that. So those are the three books. And then obviously, now I'm aware of it, your podcast is great. I've had a few of them on recently. In the background, I think like you can learn so much from people's conversations, and it's an easy way to engage with information. Those sort of things, keeping up to date with people's research, you know, is always a good one. And just being selective with what research, you know, for people who want to engage in my research, if you're not working in PE and you're working in high performance sport, you'll probably be a bit bored by it. But if you are working in PE and that's the avenue you want to take, then, and I think that's the same with all research really. So aligning what you value and what you want to learn with that, I guess. So those three books, and then there's some great stuff on social media, Twitter, Instagram, following the right people. There's some good information out there, I think.
So lastly, where can people find out more about you and your work? Obviously, you've got your ResearchGate profile as well as your own Instagram account, which has some good stuff on it.
I can't even remember what my handle is. I'm on Twitter. I think it's Ben_Pullen. It might be _. I can't remember. And then I'm on Instagram as, I have to get it up real quick. I can't remember what it is. I think it's Coach Ben Pullen it's B_Pullen_coach. That's my Instagram. For anyone that wants to follow that stuff. I try to, just kind of what we talked about today, kind of just try to show examples how to implement the constraints-led approach, and just how we have a bit of fun in our sessions. And I think I try to be transparent. Like, a lot of people only put videos of like absolute perfect competency up. And I try to put videos up that actually demonstrate the learning process. Because I think one thing we forget is children need to move. How do I say this? In order to learn how to move properly, you need to kind of move badly first. So like a lot of my children now, and this isn't to say I coach them bad movement. That's not what I'm trying to say. So a lot of my kids now sort of will recognize what is bad movement. So they might do a hex bar deadlift and I don't say anything other than how did that feel. I like asking that question. How did that feel? And you're like, oh, I'm the last one. I think I dropped my knees in a little bit. Perfect. Bang. You're coaching yourself. I don't need to be here. Just enjoy yourself. I'll go have a cup of coffee in the corner. That's where the value is. And I think if we can be transparent with that and recognize that kids learning isn't linear, it's not a linear process of they pick it up and it's there for life. It's a continual thing that we work on. And I'll try to be a bit more transparent with that, because I think we need that on social media. I think we're not all perfect. Kids movement isn't perfect. Even adult movement isn't perfect. Like, even in my own training, I get things wrong all the time. It's just a continual process. That's where I'm at with on social media, Twitter and Instagram. I'm not so big on Twitter, but I'm trying to post more on there, I guess. That's where people can find me if they want to see that sort of stuff.
And I guess as more research gets published, then you'll make that available on ResearchGate?
It'll be on ResearchGate. I always share it on Twitter. And I need to get involved in LinkedIn. I'm a bit useless with that as well. I've got a profile, but I've never really used it. It doesn't really give much away of what I've actually done in terms of my career. I think it has like one job on there. So I need to update that.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Ben. It's been really awesome chatting to you. I've really enjoyed learning more about what you've been researching and how it's been implemented. I'm sure that's going to be helpful for the listeners. So thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on and just giving me a chance to sort of talk about these things. It's been really, really enjoyable. And yeah, hopefully I'll get some more publications and can get this stuff out and start to share it a bit more. So I really appreciate your time.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you could do two simple things for us. First, if you could share this episode with another coach, teacher, or parent. And secondly, if you could leave a podcast review on your chosen podcast platform. This helps us get this resource out to more people like you who will benefit from this information.